Hello and welcome to Monocle 24, The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
Imagery, materials, spatial thinking was deeply intertwined with fascist politics. And how does one therefore reconcile distasteful politics, if you will, and the kind of compelling aesthetics?
Buildings always are some manifestation of wealth, and in the capitalist system have always embodied wealth. And much of architectural history is very much about giving shape to that accumulation of wealth.
You would get the emergence of these very, very socially committed architects' departments who had very, very strong ideas about what they wanted in architecture and what they wanted in society that were widely supported in the area, and they got to do these interesting things. But they partly are able to do it because they had a huge quantity of tax money.
We know that a city's past heavily influences how the built environment looks, but what about the impact different political ideologies can have on how our urban areas look and function today? In this episode, we bring you an extended roundtable discussion looking at the intersection between politics and city planning and design, from dealing with a fascist past to having to adapt to the rise in capitalism, and even how politics at the local level can have a wider impact on city life. For this, I'm joined by three guests. On the line from Boston is Lucy Moulsby, who's an associate professor of architectural history at Northeastern University. She's also the author of Fascism, Architecture, and the Claiming of Modern Milan, 1922 to 1943. Further north, in Vancouver, we're joined by Matthew Soles, an associate professor of architecture at University of British Columbia, and the author of Icebergs, Zombies, and the Ultra-Thin, Architecture and Capitalism in the 21st Century. And last, and certainly not least, across from me here in the studio in London, is Owen Hatherley, who's an architecture, politics and culture writer and journalist. Owen is the author of Red Metropolis, Socialism and the Government of London. So now that all the introductions are done, let's get to it. There's plenty to discuss over the next 30 minutes. This is The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Lucy, perhaps we could start with you. You're looking particularly at Milan and how this 20 years period of fascist rule shaped the city. First off, could you just perhaps tell us, how did it shape Milan?
The transformation in many ways was extraordinary, and I think that's one thing that first drew me to this city and this topic so many years ago. I had spent a fair amount of time in Italy and been to many Italian cities and then got off of the train on my way to the Brera Art Gallery and looked around me and saw a city that was so wholly different than the Italian cities with which I was more familiar. And I think was guided in my initial interest in that city by the very simple question, or apparently simple question, of why does Milan look the way that it does? And was drawn in particular to this moment of the city's history that had been long overlooked, this 20-year period of the city's fascist history, which anticipated a destruction and rebuilding of over 75% of the urban fabric. And of course, that doesn't happen, which is really part of the story. What does fascism as a political force do to transform the fabric of the city? And what are the limitations of that process?
And just tell me that strange relationship with the built form of fascism in Italy, especially in a place like Milan. Do people think of these as symbols of fascism? Because it wasn't quite on the grandeur of some of the things that were planned for, say, a Berlin. And it seems to have kind of been eased into the fabric of the city in a way that wouldn't have happened elsewhere.
No, indeed. And I think that's characteristic, perhaps not just of Milan, but other Italian cities as well, is that so much of what was done in the 1920s and 30s has become so much a part of the fabric. It's also true of Rome. When you go to Rome, you don't think you're looking at a fascist city in that sort of generic way, but in some senses you are. Our view of the Roman Forum in particular was shaped by Mussolini's reworking of that area. And in Milan, much of the center of the city was shaped during the 1920s and 30s. And then of course, Milan, unlike Rome, was very heavily bombed during the Second World War. And so that process of rebuilding was a process that was enacted on the ruins of a master plan and of a variety of broader public works projects that had been initiated and in many instances carried out in the fascist period.
Matthew, you've been looking at the extraordinary influence of capitalism on the built environment, especially in places like New York, where we've seen this move to these ultra-thin pencil towers, the construction of places where they're really nothing more than bank accounts in the sky. They're a way of depositing money, hiding money away. How extreme has that become? Why did you think this was a particularly interesting topic to look at?
Well, I think capitalism, I think we could label it as the dominant global ideology, has a kind of unwavering drive for profit and envisions all space and therefore all architecture and all urbanism as a site for the production of wealth and the storage of wealth. And there are many different, you know, often we speak of capitalism in a singular way, but of course there are many different forms of capitalism that have shifted over time and geography. And I'm really fascinated with what I and many others think is the dominant contemporary mode of capitalism in much of the world, which is finance capitalism. And I would say that, you know, finance capitalism differs from industrial capitalism, where we think of, in a kind of simple way, the production of goods to be sold at markup. Finance capitalism is really about producing profit through the exchange of financial instruments like stocks, bonds, currency. And I'm intrigued by how post-1980s emergence of finance capitalism witnesses architecture becoming more and more like a financial instrument, more and more an asset to be traded and speculated upon. And I think you can see the manifestations of that in many different diverse ways. But the towers in Manhattan, Midtown Manhattan, which are historically unprecedented in their slenderness and structural sort of bravado, are, in my mind, a kind of zenith of this financialized architectural thinking. But in no way are they the only example. You kind of see this hyper drive towards a kind of almost erratically desocialized abstraction in many places around the world in many different urban forms.
Now, Owen, we have you here in London. In many ways, that topic, you know, it could be an overlay of the story of this city. But you wanted to write about perhaps a story that doesn't get told so much and point out that actually London has this other history, this history of socialist architecture, of socialist planning, especially post-war, when there was this period where the common good was an important thing in town planning and city planning. We had the London County Council, the LCC, who put these ideas at the forefront. Again, what intrigued you about this and how lost did you feel that that story had become in the narrative of London?
I suppose it partly came out of something electoral, which is boring, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but it was kind of in reaction to the way that electoral politics, whether in general elections or the Brexit referendum, you could see London going one direction and most of the rest of the country going another. And a lot of people seemed to think this was bizarre and illegitimate, and I thought it actually makes quite a lot of sense when looked at London in terms of London's history over a long period. So there's this kind of conventional thing that people do with London of seeing it as the city that where these two things grew together, where you have a finance capital in the city and you have the kind of capital of state power in Westminster, and these things grow together and that's London. And that's broadly true. But what's interesting for me is that there's this third London, which takes shape at the end of the 19th century and kind of develops over a period really up until the mid-80s when it's forcibly abolished, which is a sort of social democratic or socialist London. And the centre for that, rather than the city or Westminster, is really the South Bank. So County Hall, which is where sort of London's Parliament essentially was until 1986, the Royal Festival Hall and the modernist buildings of the South Bank, the Coyne Street Housing Cooperative that was built next to it in the 1980s, and that you have this kind of like riverside strip of public buildings and public space. And behind that, the boroughs like Lambeth and Southwark have been dominated for many decades by social housing. So I thought that these things had left quite a lot of living legacies and had left particular ways of living, and had just left buildings a lot of the time that still existed and still often, in the case of, say, the Festival Hall or a lot of the housing, served their original purpose.
Matthew, could I ask you again, looking back a little bit, because when you think of many of the cities, you see this finance capitalism giving birth to a certain kind of architecture. Is it a case, though, of it was almost ever thus? You know, if you go back to the period of like the big American industrialists, you know, whether you're a Rockefeller or one of those grand families, you may have bought or built a huge house on Park Avenue, but never been there. It was the equivalent of our iceberg houses today. Many of the towers were built not only for places of industry and commerce, but to be displays of wealth and to be badged with people's names to represent the period of wealth that was being made then. So in a way, are our cities always representative in architecture of something that's happening in the financial world?
I think in many ways, yes. I mean, I think buildings since the time in which buildings came into being have always embodied at least three very elemental functions. One of them, of course, is they provide shelter. One of them, by necessity, is they embody cultural values. And related to that is, a separate third one, which is they are by necessity an embodiment of wealth because of the materials and labor that go into them. So I think it's fair to say that buildings always are some manifestation of wealth. And in the capitalist system, early agricultural capitalism, mercantile capitalism, industrial capitalism, you know, up to financial capitalism, have always embodied wealth and have, as your question illustrates, served to embody wealth in very extreme ways. And much of architectural history is very much about giving shape to that accumulation of wealth. I think in the era of finance capitalism, you've seen, and this is very well documented, an exponential rise in the amount of assets and the amount of capital in the world. And that's for a whole host of complex reasons, but that capital is there. And that capital is more geographically distributed than it has ever been. So there's more and more ultra high worth net individuals in more places with more and more capital, with more and more organizations and entities working to invest that capital in highly profitable locations. And real estate is an area that has been very accelerated and amplified within this kind of phenomena of what some people call the giant pool of money needing to find investments. So I think you are right that it is a long-standing phenomena, but it gets accelerated and finds more and more kind of extreme permutations in architecture and urban space in today's culture.
Just a quick sidestep question before I bring back in Lucy. Do you like any of these buildings?
Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, you know, I like them and I hate them. You know, like take 432 Park in Manhattan by Raphael Vignoli. When it was completed, it was the tallest residential building in New York City, one of the tallest by roof height, and incredibly slender, right? And it has this remarkable kind of obsession with the square. It's a perfect square in plan. Each face of the building is exactly identical and composed of these 10-foot by 10-foot windows. It is, in its kind of formal abstraction, it's incredibly sublime, impressive. I think it's a masterpiece. But what it represents socially and what it embodies is very disturbing and very worrying. So, I mean, one of the complex things when you're an architect and interested in aesthetics and beauty is that oftentimes some very terrifyingly beautiful things exist where you can find some things that one is very drawn to but also very disturbed by.
You've set me up perfectly for bringing Lucy back in here. The same question to you. Do you have that same response to this often very rational, intriguing to look at fascist architecture? Do you have that same pull and push from it?
Yes. And when you asked that question, I thought, please ask me that question too. because I think that's something that, as an architectural historian, but even more broadly as a scholar of the built environment, that is part of the push and pull of this work and of my relationship to it. You asked, you know, why are you interested in Milan? Well, part of it is that I spent a lot of time when I was starting this project with architecture periodicals from the 1920s and 30s. And the black and white photography, the images are aesthetically extremely compelling. There are buildings, probably the best known is Giuseppe Terragni's Casa del Fascio in Como, that as much as its politics are ones that I would critique and were extraordinarily damaging, its aesthetics remain incredibly compelling. And that's true not just of that building, but of many buildings and even of urban spaces. And they've been captured in films. They've been captured by a wide variety of artists. And I think another kind of layer to this, and that maybe intersects again with some of the remarks made by Owen, is the afterlife of these buildings, in which we see Italian fashion houses like Armani, like Fendi, establishing their headquarters in buildings whose making, but also imagery, materials, spatial thinking was deeply intertwined with fascist politics. And how does one therefore reconcile the distasteful politics, if you will, and the kind of compelling aesthetics? And that's not a product only of finance capitalism or fascist politics. I think we could do very much the same with the Roman Colosseum or the great cathedrals of the Middle Ages.
We must bring you back here. I'm intrigued to know, when you look at this period, is your feeling that if you had clear socialist councils running cities such as London, that you would get a better architectural outcome born from belief? Or do you think that actually it was just a very intriguing period that you're looking at? Because although you're right, it was unpicked many of the things that were put into place to support the National Health Service, support education, support public housing. It was also this, much of the period you talk about, is this interesting period post-war in every country where there was a sense of needing to come back together as a country, reforming your cities. What's the link for you between the politics that happens in the city hall and that opportunity for the kind of built environment that you obviously like?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I think the quality of the architecture, it was often much less direct. One of the things that often determined it was the amount of money that a different borough had, particularly after the LCC transferred most of London's housing construction to the boroughs, is that in places like Lambeth or Camden, you would get the emergence of these very, very socially committed architects' departments, often with people like Ted Hollenby, who was a member of the Communist Party in Lambeth, or Sidney Cook in Camden, who had very, very strong ideas about what they wanted in architecture and what they wanted in society that were widely supported in the area, and they got to do these interesting things. But they partly were able to do it because they had a huge quantity of tax money, because they were in relatively wealthy boroughs. Whereas if you look at the East End in particular, in the same period, places like kind of Tower Hamlets and Newham, they generally don't build particularly good housing in that period because they don't have a lot of money and they don't have a lot of resources. And that's where you get the stuff where the kind of original ideas may or may not have been admirable, but you get a lot of sort of system-built housing, a lot of stuff that's quite banal and boring, tends to come out of that situation where you have people faced with an enormous crisis of late, not just rebuilding after the war, but sorting out an area that had been a slum for its entire history. And very little money and very little resources to do it with. And results are pretty much as you'd expect.
Now with you, we have a Labour mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and he is on paper pushing for more affordable housing. You know, he's certainly caught up with, like every other politician, in debates about how you tackle environmental challenges. And, you know, he has an eye on making sure that, you know, his party and his administration is popular. So he tries to do some things. But is this mostly tinkering? Do you think that actually it's very difficult for somebody now who sits in City Hall to come up with a social democratic building plan that would talk about the things you're interested in? Because if education policy isn't lined up with that, if the healthcare system isn't lined up with that, oddly, they don't work in such nice ways as they did in this post-war period.
It's kind of interesting in a way. I get the impression with Sadiq Khan and with some of the people around him that they kind of have identified the problem. And whether not able or not willing to do anything about that problem, I'm not entirely sure. In terms of design, one of the things that they did quite early on was bring in Public Practice, which is a sort of firm initially came out of Croydon, who were trying to kind of bring architectural and design expertise back into local authorities, largely because of the fact that after the mid-1980s, that architectural expertise had been expunged from local authorities. You know, your average local authority in London or outside it in Britain would have a team of architects who were usually pretty good, who were working in the town hall designing buildings. And we've not had that since really the mid to late 80s. And there's been some attempt to bring that back, and there's been some mixed results. You know, there has been a little trickle of social housing, which looks better than a lot of the private housing built in London now. But the scale of the problem is huge, and I think there's sort of unwillingness to rock the boat in a lot of these people. And I think at a certain point, you really have to rock it.
Lucy, when we think about Milan today, this 20-year period is legacy of fascist architecture. It's interesting, for example, hearing Owen talk about how this legacy of social democratic housing, of socialist housing, of planning, still influences the city in many ways, right in the grandest ways, in the places where we have theatres and all sorts of things, to public housing. But when you think of Milan, does it shape still the modern city and the debate about what happens in the city? And maybe as a tiny addendum to that, I wonder if you were a young architect growing up in Milan, everyone's inspired by their environment a little way. I wonder if it almost seeps into your veins, the environment you're around, that somehow it continues to live on with the young architects and designers.
It seems to me it's almost impossible to imagine that it doesn't. I think you're exactly right in suggesting the ways in which the environment we grow up in or are surrounded by informs our thinking. And certainly that's true for architects. The legacy of the sort of transformation of the city in the 1920s and 30s is very much a part of the nature and character of Milan today. It determines where major institutions are, and many of the institutions associated with that city, the Palace of Justice, the main train station, the main square that is just off of the Piazza del Duomo. All of these are spaces and buildings that were built, laid out in the 1920s and 30s, and pushed the kind of residential life of the city in many ways outside of the city center. And so there are patterns, not just of the visual experience of the city, but also of the life of the city that were perhaps already underway, but were solidified in that period and continue to inform the way in which the city is used, the way in which the city is talked about, the way in which the city is experienced. So I think it is certainly a moment of history, but it is a moment of history that continues to shape the present day and has its own vitality as a consequence of that.
And Lucy, it's not a trick question at all, but if you were like saying to young urban planners or designers, you know, thinking about, you know, how rail fits into a city, about function and places for people to meet, and you were taking them to Milan, would you put some of these buildings on your list of places to see as best practice almost? Because we live in this strange world where anything with a minor connection to the past is often kind of derided now. But here, what's fascinating about this conversation is, you know, that especially when you speak to Italians in our office, they're like, oh, I love that building. That's, you know, one of my favourite buildings. And they know it's past and they know it's history, but still they understand it kind of works and they kind of like it. So do you think we can still learn something from that period?
Absolutely. And I think that's very well said. You know, it kind of works. You know, one of the reasons I think that at least some of these buildings and spaces have endured is that they do work. And they work in some instances relatively unchanged, but they also are open and flexible enough, not in every case, but in many, that they have withstood adaptations, changes of use, and have thus been able to accommodate a contemporary society, a one that couldn't have been imagined at the time of their making.
Matthew, when we think about the reset, looking forward, do you think there is any way that this finance capitalism's control of our cities will loosen you? Here in London, we have seen some attempts to control the amount of money coming in into the city and just being put into buildings that people never go to. There is some understanding that dirty money was coming to the city and being cleaned up by being put into bricks and mortar. There has been some attempt to, in some places, try and control how much social housing is put into a project. Very limited, but there are attempts at it. After this period of the pandemic, there was certainly a call for more action. Do you see any rollback from this, or is the world of finance so powerful that it will always win out at the end of the day?
Well, I want to be very optimistic that this moment in time affords a great potential and possibility for a shift in how things operate. If recent history is any precedent, I think there's good reason to believe that the forces of finance will continue to accelerate and find, when confronting blockages in certain locations, will find new avatars for profit and outsmart the forces that are out to tame it. So I want to be optimistic, but I'm also fairly pessimistic about it.
Just one tiny add on to that. Often the very same people are putting up these towers, and the developers, they're also funding odd little private parks, or they're funding displays of what seem like community projects as well, even if they are on a grand scale. Are these meant to be like salves that give a good name to what they're doing elsewhere? It's funny that, you know, in a North American context, the huge speculators often do these displays of public projects as well, seemingly philanthropic. Are these interconnected, or are they two different worlds?
I think they're absolutely interconnected. You know, philanthropy has long played a very important and critical role within the logic of capitalism. And I think it's so prominent in contemporary global urbanism that we could almost identify a subset of urbanism as philanthropic urbanism. And I think none of these parks or public art pieces serve to problematize the larger system of heightened inequality and kind of homogenization of space from my vantage point. So I think they do function like a form of ethical, moral insulation on part of the system. So it's sort of, let's, you know, take with both hands, but give back with one. So in many ways, I think there's a very problematic way of thinking and way of operating in which the seemingly good small gestures obscure the larger systems of heightened inequality. But it doesn't mean like this push and pull, you know, it doesn't mean that there can't be a park on the west side of Manhattan that is very intriguing and has some very attractive qualities. But how it fits within the overall system, I think we have to be suspicious.
We were talking there about potentially some minor changes to the amount of money that gets stored in buildings in London. Do you see any hopeful signs of change? Do you think there's any possibility of the kind of renaissance you would need to go back to the kind of public housing projects, for example, we have seen in the past?
I think there's a lot of desire for it, which is not quite the same thing. You know, for most of the last 10 years, especially since 2015, London has voted very strongly against the status quo and against the enormously financialized system that most Londoners have to put up with. So the people might want it, but whether or not there's the forces there to do it is the problem. And if I were looking for hope, I wouldn't necessarily find it in something like philanthropy or even in a developer doing a bit of social housing next to their gigantic block of luxury flats. In many ways, the kind of lesson of the history I'm talking about is the difference between the kind of charitable housing that the Victorians did, you know, with the Peabody Trust, where basically with George Peabody's kind of money from being a banker, you would kind of build a few bits of social housing here and there. These things didn't make a huge difference to London's poverty and inequality. What made a huge difference was what came after that, which was the democratically controlled local authorities that were then actually taxing the rich and then building housing. So if there is a kind of hope, it probably I would find it in the way that people use public space and the way that they've been using it in particular in the last 18 months. If you go down to the South Bank, particularly now that all the tourists have disappeared, you know, you still find that there is this space in which no one has any particular need or desire to spend money. It's kind of publicness is the most important thing about it. And the amount of people kind of using parks and public spaces has obviously gone up hugely for obvious reasons of people being, you know, unable to leave the city or being forced into working from home and what have you. And I think a lot of people will probably want to build on that. And I think that has political implications because the trend has been constantly towards privatizing the city and kind of policing its public spaces and reducing them. So I think that when people start trying to sort of defend those sorts of spaces, I think that's where change will come rather than from kind of hoping for kind of siphoning off something nice from something evil or from hoping Sadiq Khan will do something.
Well, siphoning off something nice from something evil. I think that's been a bit of a theme from various parts of the show today. It's been great to have everyone on The Urbanist. Thank you to Lucy, to Matthew and Owen for joining us here today. Sadly, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlo Tribello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's LCD Sound System with We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.